workers' comp bill.
Okay.
I had a couple
we're
years
back on record.
You eliminated a lot of your problems.
And need to note for the record that Representative Cott and Representative Rumford have joined the committee. And I am pleased to welcome to the committee today representatives from numerous agencies and departments within the state that relate to job training and workforce development. One of the things that I have wanted to just look at more from a personal perspective than anything else is to find out what the state is doing to prepare Alaskans for the job opportunities, not only that we have today, but for the next 10 years, and just kind of recognizing that employment opportunities change, but are the trainers that are training Alaskans for these jobs, are they flexible enough and keeping on top of things, or are they just responding to the crisis at the moment? So, in cooperation with the Department of Labor and with the private and public sectors that work in this area, we've kind of got a preview of what the state is doing today, and then on Friday we'll see what the public sector is doing in terms of coordinating what's going on in terms of job training opportunities. To start off the overview, I've asked the Department of Labor, Chris Miller, with Research and Analysis, to kind of give us a look in the crystal ball, tell us where we're going to be 10 years from now, where the opportunities will be, where the shortage, what the trends, market trends and conditions are. And then we will get into, led off by a presentation regarding what Eric is looking at, and then go into some of the other workforce development centers. So, Chris, welcome to the committee, and if you can look in your crystal ball and tell us where we're going.
Sure. Madam Chairman, for the record, my name is Chris Miller, and I'm the Chief of Research and Analysis with the Department of Labor Workforce Development. What I'd like to do is give you a very thumbnail sketch of sort of the various, if I could use an analogy, sort of the tectonic big movements that are affecting our labor force, workforce here in Alaska for the next 10 years. One of those drivers is our population and the age distribution of that population. And I'll get to that later. The other is what I'll call the change in our migration pattern to some extent. That's it's kind of the bad side of a double-edged sword, and the extremely strong economies in the Pacific Northwest and the West Coast, which tend to be a source for additional labor if we need it, and they're the in and out migration from those states has changed because there's been decline in migrants to our state. The other large issue that we'll be looking at towards the end of the decade will be possibly the construction of a gas pipeline. And there are several issues with that project that will impact Alaska's labor force and labor market. What I'd like to do is currently our population, and I'm looking at page 3 of my presentation, we're approximately around 622,000 persons. The primary driver in our population growth for this next decade is going to be what's known as natural increase, which is births over deaths. In the past, when we had a significant, like the oil pipeline, various economic changes, migration had a significant impact on our population. That's much less the case now because of the strong economies in the states that are near us.
Chris, if I can just interrupt there. You listen to the prognosticators in the lower 48, and they're saying recession is on the way. Do you factor that in as you look at the net increase, migration increase into the state, recognizing that we tend to pull more people into the state when the economy is softer down there. Are you anticipating that we will see an increase?
No, we're not. But migration, net migration, is really the wild card, because it doesn't take much for the economies in the lower 48 to sort of go bad for us to really get a headache from job seekers looking for an opportunity up here, particularly if there's a word out there that we've got a big project going on and they'll just come and look and see what they can find. We could be swamped if that scenario were to occur. That scenario is not in these numbers. But that's something to be aware of, is that if the Pacific Northwest states, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, if their economies, if Microsoft and Boeing go south and things, they start laying off droves and droves of people, it won't take a very, very small percentage of those folks to come here to overwhelm our market, the labor market. That happened in the late 70s, early 70s, and we had a huge project, and no matter what the state did, we had a surplus of labor, even though we were building, had the biggest construction project in our history. Yet we still had a surplus of labor. So migration is the wild card. It wouldn't take much to change the dynamics of our unemployment rate situation right now. Currently, we're on the good side of that equation, because we have just enough people coming in that we're essentially netting out to zero as far as migration flows, even though there are constant back and forth numbers. We're sort of netting out to zero, or nearly. But so that's sort of the picture as far as the totals go. Yes, sir.
You've got a net zero in terms of the migration, but how many are moving out? How many are coming in? I mean, obviously they're balancing there, but what are we talking about in terms of actual numbers?
15,000 in and out each year, roughly. 10 to 12%. That's probably I was thinking a percentage. 10 to 12% of our population is in and out each year.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that, how do you get that number? How do you obtain that 15,000 in and out?
We get data from the IRS. They give us summary data on tax returns by state and county, so we're able to look at. There's a considerable lag in that information, but we get tax return movement data, you know, from one year to the next. Where that.
So your data is almost a year old, probably.
At least that migration pattern is a couple years old. So there's a lag there.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that civilian population, or does that include the military?
It would include the military.
Representative Calcutt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The migration pattern. Did you said 15,000 a year?
15%.
15%.
Yeah, I said 15,000. I meant to say 15%.
15%. Is that a pretty consistent number?
It is generally about that number. Earlier in the 70s, it was a much higher number. It's been gradually declining.
So what does that do to the assertion that people move into the state to get the permanent dividend fund? If it's declining, it's actually proving that theory to be not true. So.
There is a 4 to 5%, when we look at the PFD over a couple of years, there has been a stable percentage, and right now it slips my mind, of number of individuals that showed up as an application one year and then showed up as a receipt, as a eligible the next year, and multiple years after that. But that's been a fairly stable number. And I apologize, I can't remember the number. It's a fairly small percentage, but it's a fairly stable percentage that we've looked at over the years.
So that would be contra-cyclical in terms of the total net migration number versus PFD qualifications.
Right. Generally, yeah.
So that would make the case, not otherwise, right?
So. I'm sorry, I completely missed that part, that exchange there. So you're saying it's the number has been fairly stable.
So that our economy has been stable but not strong, whereas the Pacific Northwest has been very strong. And so countercyclical is going, they're moving away from a very strong economy.
Right, but we've had qualified PFD applicants increasing at a steady but small 4% rate.
Right, yeah, the new people to the state who are staying here, and right. It's been fairly stable.
Which would make the case, probably, if it was accurate statistics.
But you're losing people every year.
We include the military in that.
Yeah.
So you need to be aware of that there's a fairly stable population of people that change every year.
As a turnover.
Just turnover. So you need to be aware of that, and that's why when I talk about nets, my hands are moving too fast.
Oh, it's windy. So.
But that's why when I talk about net, you have to be aware that there's a lot of churning underneath that. And it's really the net that you want to talk about as far as general flows, as far as demographics go.
Which would be on page 5, is that right?
Page 5 is the net migration table, yeah. And you can see the outflow, the net outflow is the mid-87, second half of the 80s, sort of the price crash. Then the late the early 90s, 89, that's the oil spill. And then in the mid-90s, that is the closure of military bases to a large extent. The ADAC Naval Air Station. And
well, Madam Chair, we're not here to talk about historic numbers, really, but I take note that in 86, 87, where there was approximately 35,000 people net out, I know the Anchorage lost 35,000 people in population in those couple of years. So is Anchorage the only place hit, do you think? Or?
No. The total net is like minus about 19, not quite 20. There was a number of people came in, so you have to also have to be aware that even though our net is still negative, there was a large number of people still coming in. I could get you the details
so
on the flow.
You didn't really lose a net 35,000.
I'd need to check the numbers.
My bottom line sure said they did. We did. Okay.
I have to check the numbers. The next chart is one that I would like to point out, and it looks at Alaska's population and its age distribution, because it will have a significant impact on Alaska's labor market. What I'll call the solid population pyramid is our population distribution 1998, and the top bulge, that is our the baby boom generation, born 47 to 55, 58, somewhere around in there, my generation. There's a big chunk of people there. Then the dearth of folks, the Gen X folks, following behind, and then the echo boom. The children of the baby boom. Then we've got projected the line drawing is showing that what we predict the age distribution will be in 2010, and what's happening in our population, our workforce, is that it's aging, and the baby boom generation is just now starting to reach retirement age, and that retirement will markedly increase as we go through this decade. The issue will be is how well, or the Gen X generation, there is simply not going to be, there is a dearth of folks following behind. Then we drop down to the echo boom. So just as we get ready for some major projects, there may not be people here that are ready to go at the right age. There's plenty of folks coming in behind in the echo boom. So there is going to be, if you just look at the economics of labor supply and demand, you can see that there's going to be a wage push with the Gen X folks, because there are not that many of them. And this is sort of a national phenomenon. We're not unusual. We may be a little bit more extreme, but this is going throughout, rippling through the entire economy.
Representative
Ruffer. Well, Mr. Miller, I answer that. This particular graphic was representative not only of Alaska but the rest of the country.
Yes, it's very similar. We're a little bit more extreme. Our peaks and valleys, but.
I always thought we had more men up here.
We're pretty close to even Stephen.
Well, I guess that I'm thinking of the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, we're not quite so extreme.
The bad old days, except if you were a sweetie young lady.
Nothing bad about that.
Mm-hmm. What this all leads to is for the foreseeable future, unless there's any dramatic changes, we will probably have fairly low unemployment rates. In our state, that's sort of the silver lining, is that anybody that wants to work will be able to find work. There are opportunities, plenty of opportunities, and there we don't have a radically surplus labor force.
Mr. Miller, how do we account for the large number of chronically unemployed, and when do they start dropping out of the statistics? Say we only have 6% of the
right.
Adult population. How do you do that statistically?
Definitionally, we define a person as being unemployed if they've actively sought work in the prior 4 weeks as to our survey week.
4 weeks.
Right.
So somebody that's on a subsistence economy, lifestyle, or mixed in the rural areas wouldn't even be, if they hadn't sought formal employment then? In a 4 week period, but not part of the base?
That's correct. It drops out. You become what is known as a discouraged worker.
In just 4 weeks.
Right.
Is that the national BLS?
That's the national.
BLS?
Right.
Yeah.
And that, Representative Rogue, is a significant issue in rural Alaska. Our unemployment rates do understate what people sort of on the street would think would be unemployed. Because many of those folks, if you ask them, they would take a job if it was available, but they haven't looked because the last time they looked a few months ago, or it's out of season, and they're not looking, so they won't show up in our statistics. And so that is an issue with our rural Alaska, as well as many large urban centers.
Is there any way the BLS or yourselves track the people that want to work? That don't qualify for the 4 weeks?
We do have, there's a survey that the BLS contracts with the Census Bureau. It's called a current population survey. There's a fairly high error in that survey. They're dealing with annual data, but it does get at some of that information. In summing, I guess what I would like to, this next chart really deals with some of the various occupations we've looked at the various ages of people in those occupations. Point out a couple examples. The top one, administrators for post-secondary schools. There are about 380 of those folks around the state in 1999, and 72% of them are over the age of 45. Not quite 50% of them are over 50. So they're depending on the occupation, there are going to be some significant turnover in the coming years. Another example would be registered nurses. There's approximately 3,700 registered nurses in 1999. Almost 50% of them are over 45.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on that chart. The first line is the administrators, elementary, and secondary. Okay, so that's just the principals and
right.
Because I see teachers is quite a ways down the list.
That's correct. It is important to note that these are just percentages. We do have the numbers that go behind them. So some of these occupations are much larger as far as number of people in them. These are just percentages.
I understand. Okay, thank you.
The next chart shows the consequence of fairly active economy in Alaska, a lack of or a decline in in-migrants, the department's effort at resident hire. Current in 1999, which is the latest information we have, 18% of our of the workforce who were non-resident. That's the best it's been in quite some number of years. There were, let's see, just under 65,000 individuals who were non-resident that worked in 1999 in Alaska. I would imagine that this trend to continue. How steeply will decline is hard to say, but the number of residents working in Alaska should improve.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, another question.
Yes.
Is it still fishing, tourism, oil, where the out-of-state residents are primarily?
The industry with the largest number of non-residents is the seafood processing industry. Yes.
Chair, Mr. Miller, you say you expect that to continue. Are you a little more hawkish on the economy than maybe I am right now, as far as the United States? You're an advocate of a soft landing?
I'd like to have a soft landing. We'll see. We'll see. I would imagine the way I'd respond would be that we are right on the bubble, and it could go either way. Time will tell.
And if we actually go into a recession in the South 48, and
this could change,
which would be two quarters, and then you would. We went into the summer season here.
Right.
We have a potentiality to see a spike up of outside job seekers.
Could very well. Yeah, it could very well happen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But in the Department of Labor, your annual report on non-resident workers in Alaska, it made a couple of interesting comments about how Alaska hire programs have been very effective in reducing the number and improving educational opportunities, promoting kind of homegrown talent. So basically, if we continue along that lines, we'll get this number down from 18% down even further then.
It's possible, yes.
And what was the numbers of state workers in your last report?
I wrote those down. For 1999, there were 64,828 non-residents compared to 293,901 resident workers.
And the definition of that is if you don't get a PFD, you're an out-of-state worker?
Correct. They have to have either applied for and received the PFD, right.
Yeah, okay. I just want to go on record. I've always disputed that as the definition of an out-of-state worker in Alaska, particularly when you have such a transient population that come up here and intend to stay here. And many of them, of course, plug into the PFD, and now then they become long-term transient residents.
Yeah.
But, you know, how it shows up statistically. Anyway, thanks.
The next chart is our occupational forecast, a forecast out to 2008. It's our most recent one. We came out last fall. We're predicting that by 2008, there'll be 318,000 jobs in Alaska, and that's up from 284,000 in this past year, the year 2000. We estimated that there'd be that many jobs. That is based on essentially a growth rate that is 1.5% stable. There are scenarios where that could change radically. this forecast did not include in it a gas pipeline scenario.
President Hopper?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your latest report, the out-of-state worker, the average salary is $13,000. What was the in-state average?
I think I'm remembering 24,000, but don't hold me to it. The in-state wage was significantly higher.
Representative
Mark. Thank you, Madam Chair. By your chart here, it looks like you're projecting a steady growth in employment. Oh, I'm sorry, wage and salary employment. Okay, no, in employment, and it didn't take in the gas pipeline. But what does it? I mean, what do you anticipate is going to make the growth? Tourism
is in there. It's a mix of the whole the service industry, which is the hotels, health industry. As our population ages, the health industry is going to get significantly bigger. The oil industry is rebounding, so that's all of our. It's a general steady growth. We do have our downs, and timber doesn't look like it's going to be growing any, if at all. But most of our industries will be growing, though the big driver is going to be the service industry.
Okay. Thank you.
The type of occupations that we'll be seeing where the growth will occur are listed on the next page. And you can then see the surface aspect of these kind of jobs. These retail sales, cashiers, registered nurses in the health industry. For instance, are the occupations with the numerically largest number of job growth that we project by year 2008.
Does this include gas line or national missile defense or any of the big projects that we hand war?
Chair, they do not. We do not. This was a pretty much a sort of a base case forecast. There are several projects on that are potentially could occur that could change the dynamics significantly.
Stab in the dark.
It was at a point where we didn't want to try to make that stab in the dark without some further information. So we just sort of did a baseline case.
So your crystal ball doesn't work any better than anyone else's.
No, it does not.
Okay. Representative Halcrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 23.4% requiring bachelor's and above, what types of industries do you think that, do you anticipate that being in?
That would be actually across all industries. Basically, what we have a profile of various occupations and basically, based on the number of occupations, we can then look at these occupations require a bachelor's degree. These kind of occupations require, for instance, short-term training. But it's across all industries. Most of your managers are going to require a bachelor's degree.
Looks like we better start funding that university, huh? Wait.
Well, what I'm surprised is there's 48% that require just short-term training. I mean, that's amazing.
It is.
In this higher tech type world, I would be I'm suspicious of that, I mean, frankly.
When you look at the numbers of just the large, of the people who actually are doing the work, they don't need a PhD to run a McDonald's. So when you in the service industry, there are a lot of people that make that industry click, and those occupations don't require a huge amount of education. Though it's critical to be aware that there's a mix that's needed.
If you're working in an auto parts shop, you might be able to run a real computer.
Mm-hmm.
and be aware. And that might take a month or two of training.
It might take some longer.
This is interesting to look at, though, because we hear a lot of talk about whether we're going to give loan forgiveness to teachers or to nurses, and kind of focusing on that end of it. And if we're not looking at that end, we're looking at the vocational education programs. We've got Fred Esposito, who's going to talk today about what's going on in the Alaska Vocational Tech Center. And yet, looking at this, perhaps the focus of where places like the VOTEC centers are going, where you're in there for a year or so in these training programs. So it'll be interesting to hear, Jim, your comments on what Eric is doing to coordinate this and making sure that we're going in the direction that we need to with these training programs. There's no record.
Now, I just can't pass this opportunity to get a plug in here. Is that you can see on this chart that the required level of education, even at the very lowest level of 7.1%, work experience in a related occupation. Now, if we had a student training wage system that really worked in the state, maybe some of the students could get some work experience if they got an easier entry into it.
We'll figure that out. Okay, if there's no further questions, for Chris Miller, we can move on to Jim Sanders, who's the director of Alaska Human Resource Investment Council, or ERIC. Thanks, Chris.
We need to find that loan forgiveness for cashiers and McDonald's. I think we're really growing.
That's right. Right.
Jim, thank you for letting me kind of rearrange your schedule, and I think that kind of helped us focus on where we need to be, so you tell us how we're going to get there now.
Okay, well, thank you, Matt Chairman. I am very pleased to be here today, and this is sort of my first opportunity to speak before a legislative committee, so
well,
a little nervous and kind of excited about it, so thank you. And I did want to recognize also your staff, Amy Erickson, who was very helpful in getting this organized, so I want to thank her. And also I have Jack Heesch here with me, who has been working with the ERIC for a few years, and I've only been here 2 months, so I may have to call upon him if that's all right with you.
You betcha.
Okay. And we did try to set it up today so that we give an overview of the public sector efforts within the employment training arena, and on Friday it'll be more of the private sector. And what I thought I would do is spend some time just talking briefly about what the ERIC is, how we were organized, both with the council and with the staff, so you kind of get a picture of who we are, and then talk about what the ERIC has done and what it is doing. And I think that will get to kind of the issue that that you're looking for some answers towards. As you know, I was going to use an overhead, but I'm going to try not to use it. Maybe it might be a little easier to. Room isn't quite as conducive as I'd hope. So, the mission and the purpose of the ERIC is pretty straightforward. It really is trying to find a way of combining both the needs of Alaska's employers with the needs of Alaska workers. The industries that are out there, the employers that are out there. Need to find a way of identifying what are the special skills and abilities that should exist in Alaska workers, and Alaska workers need to know that information so that they make wise choices when they seek employment and seek training. And the ERIC's purpose is helping to facilitate that communication between the employer and the Alaska worker, and by setting and developing the policies, the overarching policies that the various training institutions across the state use in preparing Alaska workers. So we have sort of a very broad kind of overarching obligation to the state, and what we're trying to do is build connections continually between both the employer and the job seeker. And we have a number of partners in that effort, building the connections within the workforce investment system. We certainly use the school system, the K-12, vocational education, and the post-secondary education system, the job training partnership programs, University of Alaska, the Job Center Network, the labor unions, the native nonprofits around the state that have employment training programs, and the developing effort to develop new regional training centers. So we're there trying to, you know, build that connection between the job seeker and the employer so that wise decisions are made at both ends of that spectrum. A couple things that the ERIC does that, you know, consider very important. We advise the governor and the legislature on ways to improve the public workforce investment system. And we drive the coordination and collaboration among programs, the various training programs. And we also have a charge to evaluate the investment of the millions of dollars that go into the federal and state training programs annually. A couple things that the ERIC does not do. The ERIC does not operate programs to provide customer service. We do not duplicate the efforts of other policy boards or councils, and the ERIC does not provide grants. The ERIC was created in 1995 when there was a consolidation of three different councils: the Alaska Job Training Council, the Employment Security Advisory Council, and the Governor's Council on Vocational Education. And the ERIC then was formed, actually, I think the formation began in 1998 and has continued, you know, to the present. And by statute, the membership of the ERIC is limited to 26 members. We try to have fewer members than that. I think currently we have 21, with the lieutenant governor being a member, and the representatives from four different departments. And then the majority of the representation is supposed to be made up of the private sector membership. And we also have education, vocational education institutions, and community-based organizations. The ERIC, also by statute, can only meet three times a year. And so that makes it a little difficult to bring this body together and go through a deliberative process and evaluating, you know, the obligations that we have. So we have set up a very active committee process, and there are four committees. There's the business and industry, the educational committee. There is the evaluation. Assessment and Evaluation Committee, the Employment and Placement Committee, the Workforce Readiness Committee, and the Planning and Policy Committee. And each one of them are charged with a different element of looking at the ERIC charge. July 1, the ERIC was moved from the Governor's Office into the Department of Labor. So I now work for Commissioner Flanagan, and I'm within the commissioner's office as a director. The Alice Galvin, who works for BP, is the chair of the ERIC, and we have three staff members also. So it's a very small organization, you know, Jack Eash being one of them, and we have two other project coordinators, and we're all located in Anchorage. We work very closely with the Alaska Workforce Investment Office's staff in the Department of Labor, and you're going to hear from Mike Schiffer, who is going to talk a little bit later about the programs that the state is running, both through the statewide effort and through the municipality and MATSU efforts. And, you know, a tremendous amount of the work that is done through the workforce offices are the one-stops that have been set up around the state. and there are 22 one-stops that have been set up to provide employment opportunities for both employers and for the those seeking work. And, you know, the concept, you're probably familiar with it, but an individual in Anchorage or in one of the other regional centers can come in, look for work, and get a whole range of program assistance. Anything from, needs assessment to connecting to any kind of welfare programs or training programs or direct employment, developing job skills, developing resumes, a whole host of things so that they only have to go to one place. In turn, there's also a very active partnership with employers around the state so that they know, what exists and also the opportunities that they can avail themselves of within the one-stop center of connecting their needs with the needs of Alaska workers. There are a couple things that the ERIC has done that have been very effective and I think have had a significant impact on the state. The one-stop centers that I just mentioned are probably one of the primary example of what the ERIC has been able to do. Also, there's been an active involvement in developing the school-to-work program, involving the schools in developing career pathways that lead, training within the school system into post-secondary training, which then in turn leads into jobs. Also, another active thing that the ERIC has been involved in are the community forums industry needs assessments. And that's where we have used Chris Miller and his office in labor to identify basically the needs of various industries for the present and for the future. And the ERIC normally has a fall meeting and at that time have a forum which focuses on one of those different industries. It could be transportation one year, health the next. And from that effort, a number of consortiums of industries have been created so that there is a health consortium, and that is made up of the health employers, the private sector employers from around the state, who in turn work cooperatively, and there are six other consortiums. But each one of the consortiums work cooperatively in identifying both their employment needs and their training needs, and then they can partner with the different training agencies so that their programs are designed specifically to the needs of the private sector, so that there is a true partnership and a very strong communication through the consortium effort. There's also the business education compacts and also finally the workforce investment boards, the boards being the entities that actually identify and design the programs for the workforce investment, the state's workforce investment system. And there is a balance of state workforce board, and there's also one for the municipality, the MATSU. The ERIC has some very specific oversight responsibilities that are constantly changing, and we are looking at adding new ones, but currently, the oversight for the Workforce Investment Act programs that are operated statewide is one of our major charges, and that is setting up the criteria for how those programs should be evaluated, and also working again with the various industries around the state and with the Department of Labor staff in identifying the major employment needs in the future. And currently we are charged with identifying the five high wage employment areas in the state. And then that in turn will be one of the focal points for the workforce investment programs to focus part of their funding on moving Alaskans into the higher wage as opposed to just the service industries. Also, we have oversight with the Adult Basic Education Program, the State Training and Employment, or the STEP Program, the Adult Vocational Education Program, the entire employment service operations, and the School to Work Program. currently, we have some other activities that we have going on. We are working with, you know, the Workforce Investment Act in implementing it within the state, and that is a program that is federally funded and is constantly changing. We are developing, we have a 5-year strategic plan that we'll be revisiting this year and updating that. And we have submitted our annual report to the governor and legislature and to the Secretary of Labor. And in addition to that, in Senate Bill, or 289, we had to do the blueprint for the ERIC, which was basically to outline the direction that the ERIC is going to go in the future in implementing the needs for employment training in the state. And the blueprint is something that was submitted to the legislature this year. You should all have copies of that. And there are very specific recommendations on what can be done to help implement the goals of the workforce effort. And finally, some future activities that we have that will continue and be ongoing is we are charged with continually evaluating and the implementation of the Federal Workforce Investment Act. That's an ongoing charge. Also to develop the equality assessment for the Workforce Investment Board so that they have criteria for evaluating their success. And finally, we will continue with the community forums and industry needs assessments so that we are continually pulling together a picture of what the industry needs are, the employment needs, and the private sector, and then partnering that with the training agencies. In a nutshell, that is what the ERIC is doing.
Mr. Sanders, in looking at the blueprint that had been provided to members of the committee, it's helpful because it provides all the guiding principles and kind of sets out what you do. One of the principles, I guess, is to assess and quantify the need to add, revise, or delete education and training programs. So you guys are kind of overseeing all this, taking all the information, and then filtering it out to where it needs to go. How receptive, if the information that you get is that, you know what, we just don't need to be focusing on electricians anymore. For ERIC as an oversight entity to go to Katsuri Tech and say, you guys are focusing on the wrong area. How is that received? And how do you facilitate this information without really encroaching?
Tremendous amount of turf, and that is one of the issues. Both, you know, with the ERIC, itself, with the council, is we've developed a blueprint, and we have set out specific recommendations and goals for how do we implement it, and how do we actually get organizations to pay attention. And I would say currently the feeling amongst the ERIC is that there really isn't a way of doing that, other than through, you know, the direct involvement in Mike Schiffer's programs in the funding, the programs that the state funds. Certainly we have that direct influence. But for other organizations, I think it's rather limited. We don't have the teeth to actually make things happen. But the recommendations hopefully will get us there.
So how well are you received?
So far, I've been received very well, but I'm a new kid on the block. I don't know. What would you say?
Well, if
you don't mind, if
it's
that right.
Yes.
And actually, Mike Schiffer, who's going to follow here, can probably answer some of these questions even better. But, Madam Chair, I'm Jack Heesh. I'm a member of the ERIC staff. I think, rather than looking at the we don't need any more electricians sort of perspective, you might want to look more on the we need more of registered nurses, by way of example. And the way that that interprets itself is that you simply say to training agencies, do you want to train your people for jobs that are existing, or do you want to train your people for jobs that we don't need anymore? And the answer almost universally is, we want to train them for jobs that we're going to need. So much of what we do is say, here's where the emphasis needs to be, because this is where we see the needs or the growth or the what have you. The truth of the matter is, the Department of Labor on occasion will decide that we are not simply going to pay anymore for training electricians. It's not an example I like, but I'll stick with it. And simply when somebody comes into a job center and says, well, I'm in need of retraining for something and I'd like to be an electrician, and the Department of Labor will say, that's not a job that we see as one that has a large future in it, and so we're not going to pay for that. On the other hand, here's a whole host of jobs that we do identify as jobs that are, you know, either growth industries, or there's going to be a large turnover, or part of the baby boom is all going to go away, and so we need a bunch of those folks, and we encourage people to then take that. And that's information that, in theory, they can all actually discern, that the job seeker can discern his or herself in a job center. Because those forecasts are all available on the internet, on the network, and people can punch that up.
I guess that's one of the questions that I have, because, for instance, the university, you go to the Department of Labor and get the same statistics. You, Eric, is essentially acting as a clearinghouse of information, which I think is very valuable. And I think it's very important that this information get out to where it needs to. And I just want to hear that it's working. Maybe
you
I
want
need
us to just say that?
Maybe
yeah.
I need
it's
to hear that
yeah.
from the participants.
Yeah, I want to say
it. Wendy wants to get out. I'll get out of the way and let Wendy.
If I may, Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Wendy Redmond, Vice President for the University of Alaska System. I'm a member of ERIC and was on the Education Committee that worked on the blueprint on that particular section, and it was really, I think, at my primary urging that particular recommendation went in. And people were very nervous about that because, in fact, ERIC doesn't have that kind of mandate in its legislation to provide that kind of role. I think that role is absolutely essential for ERIC, for this group to have that kind of oversight. Now, you need to understand that the Board of Regents and the State Board of Education are really not that interested in having an oversight committee try to tell them what to do. So I was in kind of an odd position on this one. But I think it's absolutely critical. There just simply is not enough money in the state going into public training programs or even federal money that's going to the workers for the training. So there has to be some group there that can help us with the oversight, with the facilitation of cooperative and collaborative programs together, and somebody who can say, listen, you know, AvTech, you guys don't need to be doing that training. We got the Alaska Works program over here doing this, or the university is doing that, some kind of oversight group. And that's what I envision ERIC being able to do. Now, they haven't done it yet. This blueprint is just hot off the press. I think that how it will get implemented eventually is if the legislature says to ERIC, we want you to provide this kind of oversight. We would like you to review requests that are coming in for job training programs from the university, from the tech centers. We'd like your opinion on whether or not these are good requests, whether they're coordinated requests, whether they're collaborating with each other. And if the finance committees or the labor and commerce committee asks for that kind of input, I think it will begin to set the stage for that.
Well, thanks. That helps, Wendy, because, as I say, I think the concept, the overall concept, is wonderful and absolutely necessary. But you want to know that, in fact, that is happening rather than everybody going off with their own agenda and quite possibly great duplication of efforts in certain areas and gaps in others where perhaps it's just not as profitable to be training electricians or whatever. Representative Roper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's interesting the use of the term blueprint on the report provided by your, because when I was in the real estate development business, we get blueprints and we would be able to read them more graphically. And, all right, see, this is a narrative. I think it would help a lot because, see, this is my seventh year in the legislature, and every year, on at least two or three occasions, I've been involved with legislation to consolidate and get this whole program more cohesive and coordinated and cooperative and collaborative and everything else. I think we're making some progress, but I really feel very sorry for my newer freshman colleagues here. There has been every acronym in the written documentation and the comments today. I'm lost entirely. I'm supposed to know this stuff. Anybody new to this legislature would be blown away by the plethora of acronyms and everything else here, which is, you know, one of the problems here with, I think, the programs we've always recognized here at the state. There's such a multiplicity of programs, and to know what the right and left hand are doing and the coordination of, I think, is really something. I think it almost would be necessary to have a graphic display of what the groups are in the state, how they interact, and what their mission is when you make a presentation to any kind of a public body. Other than that, unless you, because if you look at it, like you take just Department of Labor's responsibilities, that's those programs under that area. And then there's interrelationships. The university's role, IRC's role, anybody else in the Native community, the nonprofits, the school districts, I mean, the welfare to work, the school to work, you name the program, from ad tech to constitute. I mean, there's a lot of people involved, but I guess one of my major concerns, and always that concern is are we getting the job done and is it being effective? And I'm not talking necessarily about mission and majors, I'm talking about even be able to look at and even see the program. I guess my own personal style is I like to visualize things sometimes and see what that is, because frankly today right now, I mean, you know, even though I have a knowledge of a lot of these things, I wouldn't be able to really understand them other than trying to the good things, and that's nice, train kids for jobs. I mean, you know, other than that, what are we doing out there, you know? It's like, you know, one of my pet programs is always the STEP stuff, but I see that IRC has responsibility for that now, is that correct? Company taking the responsibility with or without Department of Labor, and this GAMA is probably, or whoever's here, representative, should probably talk about that. But, I don't know, I just... thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I would really concur with what you said, because it's taken me 2 months to figure out how the pieces begin to fit together. It's a very confusing maze.
And we've consolidated. We just, it was worse, you know. But we've got new people, new partners. You know. But it just adds to the layer.
Well, but recognizing that there is this maze out there. My concern is that this one over here knows what this one's doing, so
right,
that you don't do this duplication thing. So
that was,
again, I go back to my point. I want to know that it's working, and it sounds like it's just a little preliminary at this point to really give a fair assessment as to the success or not.
Yeah,
Eric.
Madam Chair, I would say that, you know, the Eric is really at a kind of a transitional phase, that it spent the last couple years getting organized and focused on what it's doing, and it now is at that point where it needs to begin to implement. And so you're exactly right, we are at that point.
Just keep focused on it. Do you have anything else that you want to add? We do have a few more individuals that are going to give us their brief overview.
That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Wendy, do you want to let us know what's happening at the university level?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I handed out some papers earlier that you should have. For those of you who don't know, I wear many hats at the university, having been there for 30 years. But one of my hats, I was the vice chancellor for the community college division before they merged with the university programs. So I have a long history with job training programs and still have the programs under my aegis within the university system and at our various community colleges. So I'm very much involved with Eric, with the Statewide Workforce Investment Board, which I also sit on, and kind of keep my fingers in this amazing pie. A couple of things have happened, and I'll try to be very quick. Since President Hamilton has come to the university 2 years ago, there has been really a very much of a re-energized focus on job training. That's very much his background. He, coming from the military, he understands it. He knows what it's about. He believes in being responsive to the community we serve. And what our community has been saying to us is we need people trained for jobs, which is not to say that the traditional university academic and research mission is something that is not equally as important. But in terms of trying to get new resources, the majority of all of our new resources over the last 2 years have been going into job training programs. If you look at where the jobs are in the state, they are primarily in areas of what we used to call vocational education, but that term is really not it's not an adequate term anymore. People tend to think of vocational education as programs where that people who dropped out of high school, for instance, could go into vocational education. There are very few programs anymore that you can go into if you drop out of high school, other than some of those retail training, retail jobs. We've been working very closely with the Department of Labor. The Board of Regents met several times. We had representatives from the Department of Labor Research Department come and meet with the Board of Regents to go over what were the highest demand job occupation areas in the state, and that was extremely helpful to us. The people who work in the Department of Labor Research Office are an awesome group of people who do incredible work. If any of you have not checked out their webpage, you should. It's really got just an incredible amount of information there, and we depend on it very, very much for developing our programs. We've been working with about five different consortiums that are industry-led consortiums in the development of our programs and courses in health, process technology, information technology, and transportation and logistics. And it has been just a whole new world of how we do business at the university. I think it's indicative of what's going to be happening from now on in the future. There's just in the last 5 years, there's a tremendous shift in higher education at community colleges and universities all over the country. But I think we're probably further ahead. And in fact, we've had people giving papers and presentations at conferences all over the world on what's going on here. I was on one the other day with Australia talking to us about how we'd set up our corporate college, because we have the first corporate college within a university setting in the country, where we're doing work for incumbent workers, and they've always been set up primarily within industry themselves, having to do their own corporate training very inefficiently and very expensively. But I'll get to that in a minute. So what we've done with these consortiums has been really unheard of. The process industry, for instance, the industry came to us and said, we have this aging workforce, we're in desperate shape, we need to train workers, and we need to train them fast. We set up, worked with Eric in setting up this consortium with industry. People from the industry, actually, so we created a curriculum committee where there are four people from industry and two people from the university who actually sat down and developed the course by course for this, and it's a two-year program. We now have 190 students in that program. They'll be graduating. The first class will be graduating this year. Virtually every student in that program is on a scholarship from industry. They have summer internships. They'll be walking out of that program into very high-paying jobs. And that program...
If I can interrupt, how quickly can you get a program online?
We got
if
that program...
If you identified this need, how can...
That one, 3 months.
Really?
Between June, and we had the first class online in September.
A lot of private sector in there.
Yeah. That's impressive.
It was very impressive. Now, part of the thing is, it's, you know, these things are kind of flying a little bit under the horizon within the university, and it could not be done without the support, with a very supportive administration right now, because it goes against the grain of everything traditionally at a university to have people from industry designing the curriculum. It's a whole new thing. But it worked so well with the process industry. Now we're working on the same thing with information technology and the High Tech Council, which is a group out of Anchorage, who again came to us and said, listen, you know, we need workers for our industry, and we're not frankly that interested in degrees. We are interested in a certain skill set, and they have within that industry, they have a very well-defined standards that are established for their industry, and they gave us the standards and said, this, we want a curriculum built based on these standards, and, you know, to hell with the degree, we don't care about that. We just need these people turned out, we need them out quick. Well, within another 3 months, we have a model program that we jump-started here in Juneau to test the program. It's a cohort program where we have, there are 22 students in the program. They go to school from 8 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's going to be going on for about 9 months. So it's a very intensive kind of program. Again, most of these students are sponsored students, and they'll be able to walk out into very good jobs. Now, we're not sure whether that model will work in other locations of the state, but we're starting that program in many other a similar kind of program this fall. It's scheduled in 6 different communities. So I think our ability to move quickly has the old myths about how things work at the university, I think, have really sort of gone by the wayside here in the last year, that certainly our administration and many of our faculty understand that the need to be responsive is absolutely critical right now, and that we just have to be able to move. And it helps if we're doing programs that are not requiring formal degrees, and many of our programs are not even offering for credit, a lot of non-credit work as well. The corporate college, back to the corporate college, which the legislature provided some funding for last year, and we had jump-started it the year before in response to Alyeska was the primary impetus for this program, and Alyeska came to the university and was interested in having us take over all of their training, which is about $6 million a year worth of training for incumbent, for their existing workers, regulatory training as well as other kinds of staff development training. They do provide some degree completion for some of their employees, and they were probably spending, they won't tell me exactly, but I would guess they were spending nearly twice what we're doing it for at this point. And we're in year 3 of the Alyeska training now, and we're now looking and working with several Native corporations, several banks in Anchorage. We're trying to kind of keep the growth contained because there's so much demand. And what we're able to do is be a point of single contact for industry who want to do training for their workers. We can join them together with many other companies. A lot of small owners are just not able to afford the cost for staff development and training for their employees. But if we get 10 employers, small employers together, suddenly we can make it very cost effective for them to provide that kind of training for their employees. So that's been a very exciting thing. And what we are able to offer the employers in that case is really the resources of the whole university. We have an incredible array of resources in terms of faculty expertise, and if we give the university first option, if there's nobody at the university who wants to do it, we have many other options. We go to APU, we go to the private sector, we go to industry. Sometimes we have to go out of state to get the right kind of training, but we just go get it for them. So that's been a very exciting thing. One of the things that is the most difficult for us, for the state, I think, right now is, you saw in the data that Chris was laying out, the aging of the workforce has become such an unbelievably difficult dilemma, not just in these areas of career and technical education, but in every employment category. So we're trying to face the increased training from engineers and biologists, computer engineers, you know, all the way down to construction workers. It's throughout the whole state. And the employers, frankly, are in competition with each other for workers. I met with the ASHNA group, the health consortium, a couple of weeks ago, and clearly the health care industry, both in nursing and other allied health areas, is one of the biggest areas of need in the state and one of the areas we've put the most resources into. But they are in a very difficult situation because for the same level of training, an individual can have a job which pays a lot more money and a lot more pleasant circumstances. And they understand the difficulty that they're having, going to have, even more difficult in the future, trying to recruit people into those kinds of jobs in the health career areas. When they're competing against the oil industry, and they got a lot of money, they're doing TV ads and everything, recruiting people into their industry, and they pay a lot more money. And the same with the information technology. Those guys are desperate. They're going to be putting money into scholarships, summer internships, and I don't know, Lorraine is still here, but I talked to some of the hospitals. They're going to have to step up to the plate and begin to put out that kind of money if they're going to want to begin to attract people into training programs for their career field. It's very difficult.
Representative Halker had a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wendy, we've heard quite a number of instances and occupations where it's hard to hire and retain
mm-hmm.
workers for specific fields. Do you at the university have a problem losing professors, going to private companies to grow their own talent there? I mean, I'm assuming if you lose, you know, if you have somebody who's knowledgeable in a specific field, it'd be highly desirable for a company just to, you know, hire Wendy Redmond to train our own folks.
Oh, it's an enormous problem, Representative Halcrow, especially in the areas like engineering, computer science, business, accounting, trying to keep people working at the university. We can't be competitive with the private sector. That, as well as the aging of our own workforce. We're the second highest group of people over 50. So we're looking over the next 5 years, and we're only looking 5 years out, not 10, we're going to be losing, I can't remember what it is, an enormous number, 40% of the people are in that category. And trying to recruit is very, very difficult. We're having to pay more and more money to get people to come and take the job.
So short of paying more and more money to try to get people to come and take the jobs, what else can we do?
Well, you begin to, Madam Chair, you begin to try to make it more and more attractive, especially in higher ed. It's not just the salary. If it were that easy, it's laboratory space, it's research opportunities, it's graduate students if they happen to be in an area of research. It's a package. And so anymore when you're recruiting faculty, you're putting together packages for them. And it's not just in the research areas. In fact, the recruitment is particularly difficult in some of our career areas. Trying to get people to leave industry to come and teach in a welding program, in an auto mechanics program, when we can pay them probably 30-40% less than what they can make in the private sector. So it is very tough.
No, I'll pass right now.
We've formed, and I'll wrap it up here, but one of the things that you had brought up earlier, Madam Chair, was the need to to provide collaborations and make sure that we're not duplicating. And I think that's one of the things that we've taken very seriously, because money has been so difficult and the needs are so immense. We've tried to be very, very careful about what it is we're offering, so that we are trying to offer primarily those programs that only we can do, so that we're the only ones in the state who offer programs for credit. The public institutions, APU also does it, but the tech centers do not offer programs for credit. So any program that needs an associate degree or a certificate, an accredited certificate, then we do those first. That has to be our first priority, so that we're not going to be competing with one of the tech centers in a program that they may be offering. So we try to stay away from that. Any place we can partner, we have a very close partnership with the Alaska Works, which is a union programs, so that we're not getting in their way for some of the training programs that they're doing, so we're doing those in collaboration. We work very carefully with several high schools in the state, have joint programs, so that we have students who are able to graduate from high school with certificate programs in several career areas in Valdez, Fairbanks, Sitka, Ketchikan. We have absolutely fabulous joint high school programs for vocational programs. Anchorage, unfortunately, we have not been able to get much going in Anchorage, but I'm hopeful that the new superintendent there has been much more open to some collaborative relationships in the Anchorage area. So those kinds of partnerships, we're working with Fred Esposito. I don't know if Fred's on the line, but we're trying to work out some relationships with the tech center in Seward. We have a very close relationship with the tech center up in Kotzebue, so that we have no overlap at all. We don't want to ever get into that situation. So we're doing some of the academic courses, they provide the vocational training, so we have a very compatible relationship there.
Good, that's good to hear. Any further questions?
Wendy, how do you like working with a board that has such a pompous name as the State Workforce Investment Board? did we do that to you, or did the legislature do that? Or?
I think you did do that.
Actually,
it's statutory.
It's awful. I know, it's probably, that's what I thought.
You sponsored the bill.
No, I didn't. Senator Torgerson, I believe.
I'll be really honest with you. It's been a little bit difficult. I think, like I said earlier, I think that Eric has the potential to provide a great service to the state, and hopefully in its new formation, I've always felt the board is simply too, if you have 26 members on a board, it's a little hard to do anything. But I see a great need for this kind of an oversight committee, and I really do hope that we can figure out how to get them into a position where they can provide that kind of public oversight and advocacy. There's a lot of money being spent in this state, federal and state, on job training, and I do not believe that there is a lot of overlap or unnecessary competition right now. I think things are working very well, but the potential is very great in the future too. I think what you mentioned was that we need to make sure we're filling the gap. We may be overfilling in certain areas, and that there are certain gap areas that we really need to focus on.
Yeah, it's been interesting going through the materials that were provided to the committee, because we look at them and it's like, my gosh, how many different, pick one. Marine manufacturing, that's the first time I've seen that. So anyway. But you go through and it's like, well, wait a minute, you're offering the same thing in Kotzebue that you are in Seward, that the university is. Are we overlapping? So it is nice to hear that in fact there is actual collaboration going on within the institutions, and that you do talk to one another. Because I know oftentimes it's my program, I started it first, you ditch yours. And so if you really do have oversight with a little bit of authority, and I understand that perhaps the teeth aren't there yet, but if a recommendation comes out saying, look, you've got three different facilities that are providing the same thing, you need to consolidate, that people will actually sit up and pay attention. Thank you. Representative Roper, go ahead.
I was just bringing in mind, looking at your request for fiscal year 02, In your last page, you have about $500,000 for, what's that, University of Alaska, Oakridge Southwest? What's that?
Statewide.
Oh, statewide.
What that means is we actually are ready to do this. We put in, we had a request for about $333,000 for Allied Health. At the time we made our request, we weren't exactly sure what we wanted to do, and so we've been working with ASHNA again, the State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and we developed a poll that the president paid for out of another, some private funds that we got.
No, but I guess I was concerned. I think I misunderstood where the money was going to.
It will be distributed to the campuses. We just put it there because we weren't sure at the time we put the request which allied health areas were the most important to do. And as a result of this survey that we did with ASHNA, they're defining which programs, radiography, phlebotomy, med tech assisting, and so on.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Most all of the money in Allied Health goes to Anchorage. They're the ones we've tried to...
Well, I noticed the recent encroachment of UAF on the nursing program. So.
It's an Anchorage program being delivered in Fairbanks.
Good.
I was talking
That's
about
the ultimate
turf,
insult.
You know? Look
That's
at
the
this.
Ultimate insult. There, yeah. They did it again.
We couldn't involve you in a discussion name. Without getting parochial.
That's
hey,
right.
Wendy.
That's right. There's nobody from Fairbanks here. We do have two more individuals that we have on the schedule for today. Mike Schiffer from the Alaska Workforce Investment Office, there's your name, and Fred Esposito from Avtec is also online. It is 5 o'clock, and I know that Representative Meyer and I do have another Finance Budget Subcommittee to go to, but I would like to give you the opportunity to at least say a few words. Mike, you want to go ahead?
Thank you. I'll try and be brief after having my name thrown around every time there was a question raised. So. Madam Chair, my name is Mike Schiffer, and thank you for allowing me to appear before you today to talk to you about the Alaska Workforce Investment Office. This is an office that is housed in the section, in the Employment Security Division and the Job Training Unit there. And the AWO's primary responsibility is to operationalize many of the things that you've heard about today relative to job training programs. Specifically, these programs include the adult, youth, dislocated worker programs, as well as the Governor's Reserve Fund, Rapid Response Programs, the State Training Employment Program, or STEP, the Welfare to Work Program, the School to Work Program, and the Denali Training Fund. Combined, these programs represent over $16 million in federal resources and $4.5 million in state resources for employment and training. The primary functions of the Alaska Workforce Investment Office are direct oversight of training programs, grant administration, policy development, and providing technical assistance to the local areas providing job training services, the local workforce investment boards. In addition, the agency also works directly with employers and workers who are affected by mass layoffs and job loss. As the oversight entity, the AWIO ensures that job training services are delivered in the local areas according to the mandates of the state's unified plan. This means we hold the local areas, sub-state recipients, and vendors accountable to the performance standards that were negotiated by the Alaska Human Resource Investment Council with the U.S. Department of Labor. We also examine the policies and practices of the local areas. We review appeals by participants, promote the policies and directives of the ERIC and the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We've recently completed quarterly calculations of Alaska's performance with the funds from the Workforce Investment Act and are pleased to report that we've exceeded all the minimum thresholds for performance, and on at least two of the indicators, we exceeded 100% of the performance on those indicators. We'll be working with the local areas in the coming weeks to examine our strategies for service delivery and to establish mechanisms to improve our in the areas where we didn't meet 100% of those performances. As the grant administrators, we receive and administer the state and federal job training funds. This includes calculating the within-state fund allocations, issuing and tracking the grants, contracting for job training, monitoring and reporting to the state, and federal funding agencies on Alaska's performance.
We also work with the local areas to develop capacity for service delivery and provide technical assistance to the local areas on grant management issues. AWIO, or the Alaska Workforce Investment Office, is currently engaged with the Policy and Planning Subcommittee of the Alaska Human Resource Investment Council to develop appropriate statewide policies relative to Alaska's workforce investment system. Some of the policies that are currently under development include policies relative to eligibility for training services, policies on the eligible training provider list, which you'll probably be hearing more of in the near future. Specifically, there will be a list established that vendors will need to be on that list and meet the performance standards to be able to provide services and to receive funds under the Workforce Investment Act, as well as meeting the required elements for the state's management information system. AWIO provides technical assistance and training to the local areas on matters affecting performance and service delivery. Currently, we're coordinating a statewide conference with the Workforce Investment Act, and that is scheduled to occur in late September. We've also arranged for representatives from the U.S. Department of Labor and other national experts to come and speak to field folks on training and employment issues that are specific to their particular needs. The Alaska Workforce Investment Office administers the Rapid Response Programs. Rapid Response Services are deployed in response to a significant reduction in workforce by a local employer. Rapid Response Services include meeting and working with the employer and labor groups to mitigate the impact of a layoff and providing technical assistance to local area officials to develop plans to mitigate the economic impact on their community. We're currently working with Ketchikan, Fort Greeley, Metlakatla, the Aleutian Islands, and the Kodiak Island boroughs. In addition, we are providing direct services to affected workers of the Alaska Marketplace closure in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Wasilla. In July of this year, we began administering the Denali Training Fund. The Denali Training Fund was developed by the Denali Commission to promote training of local area residents on Denali Commission-specific projects. The Commission set aside $2 million for training assistance last year. To date, over $1.5 million have been obligated for training assistance. Some of the communities directly benefiting from this training include Bethel, Buckland, Circle, Elam, King Salmon, Kloak, I can never say this one, Kongiganiak, thank you, and Ugashik. Each of these communities received anywhere from $25,000 to $100,000 in training assistance. And as a result of that, 152 rural residents are being trained for employment on Denali Commission projects. Then there's the State Training and Employment Program, or STEP, and it's designed to reduce claims against unemployment and meet the emerging training needs of the Alaska employers. STEP has been in operation for the past 10 years, and last year, 1,526 STEP participants completed training and entered employment. Upon exiting their training, participants were averaging an entered earning rate of $14.50 per hour. The Alaska Workforce Office tries to play a key role in coordinating the training resources to achieve the objectives that are outlined in the Alaska Unified Plan. We look forward to continuing to work with the Alaska Human Resource Investment Council and the Alaska Department of Labor for leadership, guidance, and direction in promoting training opportunities in Alaska. In addition, we're trying to be sensitive to and respectful of the authority and leadership of the local workforce investment boards. We think by working collaboratively with these entities, we expect to achieve the performance standards of the Workforce Investment Act and the Workforce Development System. Thanks.
These questions of Mr. Schiffer, Representative Roper.
Yeah, I noticed somewhere in here that the Iroquois had responsibility now for the STEP funds. Is that true?
That's true, yes.
Whereas the previous way, I'm noticing in your fact sheet here, it has the targeting points about unemployment, unemployed insurance claimants, women and/or minorities. Are these in descending order or what now? Is there any priorities there?
I believe there are specific priorities set, and those are not outlined.
Has that always been in the program? Because I've never remember seeing
those. Those have always been there, yeah.
I mean, the people who pay this insurance money out and then lose a job are actually behind the line in terms of getting the benefits?
No, they're the first priority.
No, well, oh, unemployment insurance
claimants. Unemployment insurance claimants, yes.
Okay. I don't mean to be sexist, Madam Chair. I don't think that women and minorities are... Anyway. So, I've always had a great deal of heartburn about where the step money went in the state, and that's why I was really glad to see Eric controlling those monies.
Yes.
So the council is actually allocating whether those monies go to what type of training program?
Right. They use the formula allocations to determine what are the appropriate amounts of money to place in Anchorage versus the balance of state.
The formula?
Yes. Yes, sir.
I don't think they ever owned up to the formula anymore. Because the Anchorage Metsu area has always been short shifted on this really terribly.
Well, there is a formula allocation representative that takes a look at unemployment rates and uses that figure to determine which group of claimants are most likely to be affected.
Number crunchers over there.
Yeah, we can thank Chris Miller for helping us.
All those nice things you said, take it back.
Anchorage, I think the last I heard, had like a 5.9% unemployment rate, and that's significantly lower than some of the rural communities outside of the Anchorage-Matsu area.
Well, I guess one of the problems I have is one step, when I first came down here, they were training miners for jobs that didn't happen in Fairbanks or something. I mean, it was really bizarre. Plus, there was a tendency to fund apprenticeship programs that were under organized labor and other kind of things like that. So do those things kind of still happen?
Some of those things still do happen, yes. The apprenticeship programs periodically receive funding. They do apply for grants and compete for those funds then through that process.
Oh, they did. Right.
So they would compete through the Anchorage Matsu, as an example, for those funds.
I just mentioned the chair that one needs to be keep a very jaundiced eye on this particular thing, but I'm really happy to hear that Eric may be leading the pack and directing where those monies are going. And let's see. Do you know, was the Workforce Investment Act of 98, was that Senator Torgerson's bill, or was there another bill last year where we reallocated some of the STEP monies?
The Workforce Investment Act of 1998, Representative, was a federal act.
Oh, that one, okay. But Senator Torgerson had a bill last year, I guess it was, that reallocated some of the STEP money into the...
Representative.
Is that right?
I think you're speaking of Senate Bill 289.
Right.
Yes.
Right. That was last year. What did and what was the result of that legislation?
$4.5 million were allocated for the STEP program where folks received direct services, and approximately another $4.5 million was allocated to the university, I believe it was Alaska Vocational Technical Center and Kotzebue
right.
Technical Center.
That was a one-time thing, though, wasn't it?
That's correct, yes.
So what's the ongoing additional allocation? Is that what's going to happen to that money?
The expectation of the remaining $4.5 million
right.
would be that the Alaska Human Resource Investment Council would set the priority for how those funds would be distributed, and then we would distribute those funds to fill those appropriate occupations that they've identified as high-demand, high-wage occupations. And I suspect they would be looking to Chris Miller's office for that data to make that decision.
So it really does come together.
Right, that's why that bill made a huge difference in terms of, quite frankly, Madam Chairman, I think there was a lot of politics being played with those monies for years. And the workers of the state of Alaska didn't know they were even paying them. And I didn't know about it until I got down here. But anyway, surprise, surprise. Taxi to death. Yeah, anyway, okay.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you taking the time and coming and educating us. We've got Fred Esposito on the line from Avtech. Fred, I hate to shortchange you, but can you give us Avtech in 5 minutes or less?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate very much the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. Thanks for allowing me to join you by teleconference. Alaska Vocational Technical Center has been providing, has been the state's premier accredited vocational technical center. We are leaders in the state for providing technology education and training. Last year, Avtec provided certification and certificates for 1,542 Alaskans, and those Alaskans became certified as mechanics, chefs, EMTs, industrial electricians, ship's captains, welders, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning specialists, physical plant managers, information technicians, accounting clerks, health care providers, power plant operators, among others. These graduates of Avtec, Avtec's been educating Alaskans for careers in business and industry for more than 30 years, and our students can choose from our comprehensive programs in over 20 different fields, each with an industry-approved certification. As you know, Avtec is located in Seward, and we emphasize timely program development responsive to the needs of business and industry. Students in our training programs benefit from small classes, hands-on instruction, close faculty supervision, and the use of the latest technologies. We provide student support services to help students succeed. We draw students of all ages from all over the state. Once they have completed their training, they are equipped to pursue careers all over Alaska, assisted by our first